Most Thursday nights during the summer, we have what's called a forum here at Holden Village, which is an opportunity to hear from all of you, your ideas about some topic of interest to us. It's not a debate exactly, and we're not planning to resolve any of the issues. It's more of a conversation, a chance to hear some panelists that I asked to say a few words, and then to open it up to all of you. And the issue this week is very broadly defined as a question: how do we bring the Rio Earth Summit back home? And as you probably heard, the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development was held in early June in Rio de Janeiro this year, the second environmental summit that the United Nations has ever had. The first was in Stockholm. And we can talk about how significant an event this was, whether it was a success or a failure. In some ways, I think it was very mixed. Most people that I know were quite disappointed, especially with our United States government for not taking a stronger position. On the other hand, I think much was accomplished. And perhaps what affects us the most, or what we can actually do something about as people of faith, is to struggle now with how we take some of what happened there, or some of the issues that were presented, even perhaps the areas that were not adopted, how we take some of this concern and commitment back home, however we define that, to our church communities, our homes, our houses, and to our country here as we try to affect our government and be responsible citizens in the world. Just, we don't have to belabor the Rio Summit so much, but as you probably know also, the two things that were finally adopted by the conference were a commitment, a rather modest commitment in the area of climate change. That's on the whole global warming issue. There are not actual targets set for reduction of carbon emissions, carbon, but there is a commitment to try to stop global warming on the part of nations of the world. And then the biodiversity treaty was also adopted, although not signed by our country. And then some other treaties that were hoped for, like the Earth Charter and the Forest Treaty, were not passed. Isn't that right? Yeah, Malaysia, I think, was leading the way to block the Forest Treaty. Mm-hmm. So the results were mixed. But anyway, we want to hear from all of you about how you take the environmental issue back home, and development too. The nations of the South were very clear that environment and development cannot be separated, that the whole question of just development and a fair distribution of the Earth's resources is an essential part of this whole environmental issue. So the people that I asked to talk tonight are Sven Westland, who's been who was a carpenter long term here at Holden Village and involved in the environmental issue, and he's going to talk about, I think, about a conference that you were at and some of your own reflection. And Lisa Stone Hazelwood, right?
Uh-huh, right.
Who's a doctoral student at Union Seminary in New York and helped to lead the session this morning on an environmental ethic. And Mark Douglas, who is the village garbologist here at Holden Village and has environmental ideas too. So we didn't actually arrive at what order we're going to go in here. Sven, do you want to start? Should we go from this way?
Move over here with Facebook. What Barbara referred to, I went to Fresno in February. From here, that was a good time to leave. So focus on church and land. It's a yearly conference that deals with issues of church and land. And the way I would like to say it to you is that you have notice, in the big cities, we have the homeless. And if you've driven very far to get here in your car, you have come through places in the United States where we have plywood in front of store windows and where there are empty houses. And probably we should not think that the homeless situation is a city problem. It's a rural problem that's handed over to the cities. Not that people came right from the rural area into the city. But the paradigm in the country has changed so that people are not so tied to the land anymore, and they are moved off. And where I think we should start remedying that is to take serious the what we read in Genesis about the dominion. With every dominion, there's usually a title of the person who is over that dominion, and the first one I'm sure I had before I ever had a name was son. And what does it mean to be son? And what does it mean to be responsible there? And then later on, what does it mean to be a responsible Boy Scout and a paper route carrier? And all these things that come on in life, some of them have land with it, farmer. And in each of these, to act responsibly. Then as communities, we also have to look at what goes on and there act responsibly. And that's where, when we don't, in former times we've had the prophets to tell us now we are off course. And I think probably what Focal would like to say for itself is, let us look at the situation and see if we can come up with a better paradigm and be prophets.
And what is the name? Can you spell out the acronym, or what's the name of the organization? FOCA?
FOCA. Focus on Church and Land. I would like to give an example of how people can gradually lose touch with the land. In the West, irrigation is very important. In California, there are many, many irrigation districts. There are two types, really. The way they're organized, some it's one man, one vote, and some it's a vote per acre. And the communities that spring up are different, because when it's per acre vote, then you don't have to live there. You just have to have the acres. And you have an influence on what goes on in the community, even if you don't live there. But the people who live in the community, they have more at stake at what happens in the community. Now it's legal to sell water, and it's been debated a lot whether you should do it or not. My personal opinion is that you should. But I feel that with that, we should use the Jubilee principle, that we transfer water to another place because there are other places where it can be better used, but it's not a permanent thing. When land has been developed and you have orchards and fields in this whole irrigation district, think of what happens when just one third of it is sold to some other place. The two-thirds who are left will have to bear the cost of the canal system and the drainage system. And then what happens to the community when it gets smaller and smaller? That's when you start to see the boarded up storefronts. And people have to move out. So if water isn't transferred permanently, but can be returned sometime, there's hope for a community again. What can happen is that the bank may whisper in the farmer's ear that you can really keep your farm, you could sell your water rights. And what will the man do then? He will drill a well and help lower the water table. And it's not just his water table, it's the neighbors. You're affecting the whole community when you start changing things. And that's not just individual responsibility, that's communal responsibility, and a different way of looking at domain and how we should deal with it. And that's not something that has yet affected agricultural communities a lot, but it's feared that it will. that doesn't really deal with climate change and biodiversity, but it deals with the place where we are in communities and how we deal with each other. Do we put, as Isaiah said, put house to house and field to field so we are finally alone when we consolidated so much that we don't have neighbors we can even see anymore? Why don't you go on?
Okay. Well, I think I'm going to end up in a place similar to you, in a way, talking about something that we can do in a community. As I thought about this, I told Barbara that this was too big a question for me to think about. Number one, I wasn't in Rio, so I don't know what I can take back from Rio. I can respond to Rio somewhat, and as we were talking, as we thought about what to do, it was hard to say what a response to Rio would be, because it is a fairly mixed response that most people had. I don't know if anyone caught an article, just a very short one, by Larry Rasmussen in Christianity in Crisis. And really it was three brief, few paragraphs each, reports from the three different perspectives that one might have post-Rio. One that it was a success, one that it was an absolute failure, and another one that it was mixed, and at best it was an adequate first step. And I'm going to go on the assumption that it's an adequate first step. But I'm also going to go on the assumption that there are some things that we do need to do in our communities, and in some ways it's the same as some of the things we've been doing. I wanted to start with a short story, and it's about my son. We have a big struggle every day when he has to put the suntan lotion on before he goes outside to go to Narnia in the morning. And the last time I was trying to do this without getting it in his eyes and in his ears and in his mouth, him wiggling all around, I told him that, you know, well, the ozone layer is thinning, so it's even more important than ever that you think about being out in the sun and taking precautions. And he said, "Mom, there are no aerosol cans up here and no cars." Now, he had it partly right. As a five-year-old, I think that's pretty good. But what it brought home to me was that he may have some of the details wrong, but he's really clear that his behavior, that our behavior, has something to do with this problem. Now, of course, it was to get out of the suntan lotion, but nonetheless, I consider that he's on the right road. And that's, I think, where I always end up, is that even with an overwhelming question, I need to start with some very small things that I can do, and I need to start by connecting with some people who'd like to think about the same sorts of things. So I'm not really going to deal with climate change and biodiversity or any of the specifics, but what I thought I wanted to discuss briefly, and hope that you have more response to it, is a kind of process that I would suggest, or certainly some elements, some of the many elements that might be necessary to a process that would help us on the way to responding adequately in our local place. Let's call it a congregation for the sake of discussion. And I'll just share with you a couple elements that I scribbled down and hope that you have more ideas. I think the kind of process that's needed is, first of all, at least partly, very theological. And when I say that, what I mean is I think it has to help us make the link between thinking globally and acting locally. I think it has to be an expression of our faith. It has to be based in both experience and the Bible, our reading of the Bible, and discussion between a maximally inclusive group of people who bring to that discussion their own diverse experiences and their own diverse interpretations. So those are really two elements, I guess. It is partly theological reflection that I think that the process needs to be grounded in both our experience and our reading of the scriptures. And that it needs to be maximally inclusive. When I say that, I think what I mean is that it needs to include as many different people as possible in the place where we're gathering. That attention, I think, needs to be paid to the people who have power and don't have power, to who's represented but who's not represented in the congregation, or better yet, in the community beyond the congregation. Today, this morning, we looked at the ELCA statement, the social statement on the environment, and it talked about hearing the other voices. I love the line about also hearing the cry of the earth. So hearing those advocates for the earth, those people who have perhaps been involved in advocacy for a while and may know more about some of the specifics of the issues that are listed and others that may impact us more in our local place. Let's see. I think the process ought to have some goals, that it ought not to just be open-ended. I mean, I think we need to be very intentional about saying, okay, the goal of this process we're in together, this inclusive group that has some skills and is aware of its environment and its specific context, the goal is that we will formulate some principles that guide our work. Now, the principles the study this morning used stemmed from a sense of justice as solidarity and as sustainability, as sufficiency, and as participation. Now, those are good ones, but it may be that a group decides that one of those, or several of those, or other of those are the principles which guide the process. And I'm not saying that it has to be a certain thing, but that one has to think about what are the guiding principles that we're going to employ in deciding how to act where we are. And that's really the final point I wanted to make, was that I think it has to be action-oriented, that we're beyond study, we're beyond simply discussing the issue. And certainly that came out in many of the small groups this morning. We're beyond being able to have the luxury to talk about these things, and we need to decide what we're going to do. And I think that has to be in the place where we are with the people that we're with.
So. As the village garbologist, I kind of tend to see things from the trash side. So I was asked to come back with something that perhaps we could learn or apply from the Rio conference. I got to thinking a lot, especially about this particular community. Just kind of trying to intuitively map out how we function, perhaps as a model for how the world would function, in the sense of, again, community, coming back to what the two of you have pointed out. During my time here, I've noticed a particular dynamic among the people. If they don't know each other, or if they don't know me, or if they don't feel connected to the people that are here, they don't tend to see themselves as responsible for what they throw away. They don't tend to notice that the bag of unsorted trash that they toss in any can ends up coming through and becoming a job for all of us, or whoever happens to be on the team that day sorting the trash. In the wintertime particularly, there's a lot more connection. Perhaps part of this comes with a smaller size.
More scale.
A group of people that knows each other or has had time to get to know each other. But when people find a connection, when they feel connected to the group, then the change is inside. They find themselves, I guess they find a sense of accountability in themselves, and they realize that what they do is going to affect other people who they ate dinner with, who they attended a session with, who they had a conversation with. All of a sudden, it's not anonymous bodies that are sorting trash. It's real people. On a larger scale, I think we can see this in our international community. We can bring back from the Rio conference a better sense of who we are, I guess, as a global community. The United States, we have a better sense of who the people in Brazil are, what their interests and their needs are. The people in Japan might see the people in Germany in a different light. The fact that that all people can be gathered in one particular place, interacting, sharing ideas, getting a feel for one another's needs, I think possibly is the best thing, perhaps the foundation of anything else that's going to follow, bringing back a sense of global community, I think is possibly the most important thing that we've brought back.
Finally, Mark Olson, who's been running this summer the Wilderness Spirituality Program for Holden, and also carries a portfolio called Care for Creation. Do you want to say a few words?
Yeah, I would. I'm all out of profundities this evening, so I'm going to borrow other people's words. I'm reading this from a book called Christian Theology and the Future of Creation, which was compiled after a Holden Village conference here in December of 1989, where people came from all over the country to discuss Christian theology and the future of creation. And a great many people were invited to attend. Fewer than a great many people attended, but the discussion ranged widely, and was a very, this is actually a very fine compilation of the weekend, and papers that people sent in who weren't able to attend, as well as letters to the conference as to why they weren't attending. And I'd like to read this letter by Wendell Berry, who was invited to come to hold and participate in this conference. Wendell Berry is a farmer who lives in Kentucky and writes prolifically, both wonderfully clear and concise prose addressing culture and agriculture issues and farming and environmental relationship issues, as well as wonderful poetry. I'll just read his letter, it's a short one. I thank you for your invitation and I'm sorry to be unable to attend. For me, the problem is less with the Bible and interpretations of the Bible than with organized churches, what Dr. Barney calls the building. The building nowadays is typically expensive to build and to maintain, expensively decorated, expensively comfortable, air-conditioned in the summer, overheated in the winter, sealed against the outside world in order to maintain comfort, surrounded by a large parking lot which is covered a few hours a week with expensive automobiles. Similar buildings house church schools, church leaders, church administrators, etc., etc. All of this is dependent upon the economic and industrial activities that Dr. Barney's letter deplores. Though some churches sometimes deplore some of these activities, they can only do so by hypocrisy, hoping secretly that no one will hear and agree. I don't see how one can be a Christian and not deplore all of these activities and try to bring them to an end, which is pretty much to say that I'm having trouble seeing how one can be a Christian and belong to a church. I suggest that organized Christianity will not be effective in opposing the evils that are destroying creation until it has the vision and the guts to unbuild itself. I'll just throw that out there for the forum.
Okay, now let's hear from some of the rest of you. If I'm curious if any of you followed the Rio Summit wells in the papers, if it affects you or if you think about it, or if not that specifically, then this environmental and development issue in general, how you think about it, how you see yourself as taking it back home, how do you see the challenge to us as the church or the Christian community unbuilded from the church to lay this task to heart and take it home, whatever that means to you. And you don't have to respond to what anybody has said here. You can throw in your own two bits, and we'd like to hear from you.
I just have a question. I know that I remember reading that the United States was willing to go along with the climate change legislation as long as there were no binding regulations or deadlines or dates, only targets. And that infuriated many other countries around the world who said that it is time, we are ready to set some very clear targets for emission regulations, and that the only way the United States would go along would be if they took those specific deadlines out.
So
and I would like to know what it was about the biodiversity treaty that caused our U.S. government not to sign it, because I read the article by the head of our Environmental Protection Agency, who had been taking leadership on it for 2 or 3 years. I believe it was in large part Dan Quayle's group, the Council on Competitiveness, that really vetoed that. And I don't know any more about that, but I'd be interested if someone else knows.
I can respond to this.
Okay. Who are you? Tell us your name. This is Joe Everson.
I'm Bud Mogelson. I belong on the Science and Technology Committee here at Holden.
Oh, great.
That's a committee that, Holden is a city. I mean, if you look around, you have all of the environmental problems at Holden, you have in the city. And so, one of my jobs is to address some of the issues associated with
Where do you live and what do you do?
I live in Los Alamos, New Mexico. I'm a scientist, I'm a physicist. I work in nuclear energy, fusion energy. I can guess, I can't really answer your question, but I can guess what the problem was, and I can also give you a little bit more information than I know about. My guess is that the concern that the U.S. had over that particular aspect of the treaty is due to the fact that the United States creates about, this is an approximate guess, it's 50 to 60% of the carbon dioxide pollution in the world. And if you think about that, if the restriction is enough, the impact on the United States would be tremendous economically. And I think that's my guess, is that it's an economic concern. That's why they would want, if the deadline becomes a problem for us. And all of you should, I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but gasoline in our country is very cheap. And you go to Europe, and you're in a different world as far as your gas is concerned. You pay almost triple what you pay here. There's a couple things that they were concerned about, and other things the U.S. was concerned about concerning the treaty, and one of them was that there were no binding restrictions on the way that the different countries were to use the funding that the U.S. was to provide. And so, although you may give Brazil $100 million. They weren't bound to spend that money in the direction that was agreed upon. There was no binding statement. Another problem that they had, let's see if I can remember. The treaty contained a situation where the U.S. would have had to give up patent rights to a number of its studies in genetics, biogenetics. Mm-hmm. But had given up those rights to countries that, we had done all the research, we just basically lost that. So those were a couple things that were concerning. So I hope that gives you some additional information. That's, those are some of the things that, that kind of stuck out in my mind when I was reading about the treaty.
And there is a tension within the Bush administration on this issue. William K. Riley, who was our chief negotiator there, has had a public and serious rift with President Bush, releasing a memo even that he sent to all his whole staff of some 15,000, I think it was, criticizing some of what happened. So it's not, the position of this administration is not unanimous.